Okay, thank you very much. I hope now that you've had lunch, you will all politely go to sleep, and David will tell me when I can wake you up. Of course, I have to say thank you very, very much to all of the organizers. We all feel this as a really historic occasion, which has given us great courage and excitement and pleasure. What has given me more pleasure is not only to see some of the great names of the journey we've all been on for the last 30 years, but so many new people, so many younger women, women of all parts of the world coming here together. And that is, of course, where the feminist future lies. So I'm delighted to be speaking to you today. Can I have my presentation, please? The title is called Notes from a Feminist Front. I am not interested in a unification of the historical chaos any more than I am in the clarification of the individual chaos, and still less in the anthropomorphization of the inhuman necessities that provoke the chaos. What I want is straws, flotsam, names, dates, births and deaths, because that is all I can know. Maya says the background is more important than the foreground, the causes and the effects, the causes than their representatives and opponents. I say the background and the causes are an inhuman and incomprehensible machinery, and venture to wonder what kinds of appetite it is that can be appeased by the modern animism that consists in rationalizing them. Rationalism is the last form of animism, whereas the pure incoherence of times and men and places is at least amusing. So wrote the Irish playwright Samuel Beckett in the diaries of his solitary journey around Germany during 1936 to 37 to visit major public and private collections of old masters and modern art. I came across this while researching testimonies to the condition of Germany and the accessibility of modern art collections during the 1930s for my current research on the German Jewish artist Charlotte Salomon. I was astonished to realize the extent of Beckett's engagement with the history of art. He thought through pictures. But I was arrested, however, by this entry in his diaries. Although Beckett writes about arts quivering with excitement when recording his responses to paintings, and that's a quote from James Nelson, he also wrote down prosaic details of painters' dates, schools, and influences extracted from extremely dull catalogues. In doing so, Beckett expressed, according to Nelson, an idiosyncratic view of human knowledge and its limits. I quote again, "I want the old-fashioned book of reference, not the fashionable monde romancé that explains copiously why, for instance, Luther was inevitable without telling me anything about Luther, where he went next, what he lived on, and what he died of. I say expressions like historical necessity, Germanic destiny, start the vomit rising upwards." Now, Beckett's recalcitrant phenomenology might seem a perverse starting point for a discussion of our current state of play, where in a conference initially brilliantly titled Feminist Futures, although that might sound a bit too Wall Street, now reduced to the single prospect, I am invited to think about a feminist past, or rather feminist writing of arts histories. How does our retrospect on feminist studies shape what might be our future is the question I want to address. Now, I honestly didn't know how to do this in 20 minutes, and I probably haven't. So our friend down there will cut me off at the cut pass. In fact, I've written about 8 papers addressing the problem of this conference, using my dear friend Catherine de Sager to judge which was just too pessimistic or too miserable, and which better captured the hopeful mood occasioned by the event's title. So I've settled for a compromise using Samuel Beckett both to introduce some somewhat dry historiographical speculations of the paper and to justify a parallel presentation on times, women, and places that you might find more amusing than my dry and probably rationalizing reflections on feminism and the writing of arts histories. What I'm going to offer you on the PowerPoint is a visual diary of 1 year from a feminist front. Homage to Anne Kawara, this feminist is still alive. Beckett's rejection of those who impose a rationalizing explanation of historical occurrences does not imply an anti-theoretical stance, uncritically returning us to positivist art history of dates, names, and art biography. Beckett is too intelligent for that. Rather, he is disowning a particular kind of historiographical trend that so radically sacrifices the living processes of singular, thoughtful, and interesting human actors to the absolutes of non-human abstractions, be that class struggle or the women's movement or the idea, that we lose the necessary balance between structure and agency, determination and poesis, and of course any sense of the lived dimension of the chaotic processes that are the raw materials of our historical analysis. A systematized historical retrospect may promise us mastery of the past, but it also risks imposing a deadeningly abstracted grid of meaning, and I think this is what has happened. In our feminist subset of art history, we seem to have become trapped in a rationalizing model for thinking about our own history since the 1970s, a divisive model of nationalities and of succeeding generations, laid out in 1989, argued over then, but repeated ever since. According to this model, feminism can be divided between positivist Americans and over-theoretical Brits, between an activist founding generation and an over-intellectualizing and theoreticist succession, or between, as we heard this morning, essentialists and constructionists. These divisions not only repeat the worst habits of art history proper, which usually organize art into national groups, French school, German school, Italian school, so there's the American School of Art History and the British School of Art History, but the problem with this, and this model particularly, is it entirely erases the international diversity of feminist activity in art and art history, which is occurring at different moments according to complex conjunctions of local, social, cultural, and political histories. It is crucial that we recognize that the lights of feminist engagement are flashing on in different places and at different times according to these contingencies that collectively weave a global text of international feminist work. Thus, feminists emerging in post-1989 Eastern Europe, post-Franco Spain, post-martial law Taiwan, post-emergency Korea, post-apartheid South Africa, meet feminists who were long since shaped in the resistance to fascist dictatorships in Argentina and Chile, or to feminists in the former West Germany, where, as you will know, since the early 1970s, an annual conference of women art historians was regularly attended by 800 to 1,000 women. Or we might go to Scandinavia or Italy, while only recently, in the last 2 years, can one say that France has a fledgling feminist movement or a discourse in art. Our first obligation to the future is to write expanded international perspectives on art history, grounded in the shifting historical conditions in which feminist discourses and practices in the plural, have emerged worldwide. We link up the dots on a global map that is not made by NATO, drawing strength from the early starters while enriching all of our practices by their co-emergence and the continuous unrolling of feminism across these significant differences. In 2005, I attended a conference in Seoul, Korea, a women's studies conference where 3,000 international women met from all parts of Asia, Africa, Latin America, rather fewer from Europe, some from America, and all to a woman was proud to stand up and say they were a feminist, whether they were a Buddhist philosopher from Thailand or an NGO working with food preservation in AIDS-stricken countries of the world. Now, the second habit, namely thinking in succeeding generations, must also be challenged. It too easily naturalizes ideas of succession and even invites supersession for its own sake. It models a long-term political and academic project on the family and installs Oedipal rivalries at their heart. Following Donna Haraway and Brache Ettinger in their different ways, feminists should seek for non-Oedipal models that do not encourage daughters to revolt against their mothers, do not encourage us to create oppositional camps marked by the notion of priority, seniority, authority, or even the pressure for novelty. Elective affinity, co-alliance, co-emergence, and transmission of our accumulated potentials, resources, and struggles will alone ensure that that which has evaded women's movements to date, sustained creative continuity. Feminist analysis of the psychic life of institutions as well as of individuals have consistently pointed out how, as women, we lack stories, myths, fantasies, and even theories that can mediate generational anxiety and deflect it towards hospitable creativity and woman-to-woman continuity. The originating claim of sisterhood was broken on the revelation of the truly agonistic struggles between women, horizontally, around race, class, and sexuality, and geopolitical position. Luce Irigaray has pointed out that without such mediating tales about mothers and daughters, women's movements tend to regress and become discouraged, being only fleetingly inscribed into history. Is this what has happened to us? After over a decade of backlash and the claim that feminism was over, just want you to watch this for a moment, we seem to be facing one of these critical moments of erasure. As you can see, the Impressionists, only four men and no Pizarro. Can you imagine 2006 with all that we've done about Jewish studies and feminist studies? That could be the BBC's prime docudrama on the great brotherhood of the Impressionists. So after a decade of backlash and the claim was feminism over, we are in a bit of a pickle. A glorious history of the flowering of international, intellectually and culturally creative feminisms can be charted from the 60s to the 80s. A whole new field of academic studies was created. Feminist perspectives have revised and are still revising every discipline they touch. Powerful alliances have been made between feminism and historical materialist, socialist, and post-colonial critiques, between criticism and the analysis of sexuality, subjectivity, and semiosis. Taking part in one of the most significant intellectual revolutions in the humanities, feminism once seemed a leading force, occupying a secure chair at the table of cutting-edge debate. But the tide has turned. Queer theory, still in fashion. Post-colonialism, absolutely necessary. Feminism, optional extra. Feminist journalists have tracked a backlash, and which we have lived out. We have seen the institutional persecution of older feminist scholars and artists, the closure of feminist programs, the active derogation of feminism as not only past its sell-by date, but just simply not sexy and interesting enough. It may be that feminism, rich with the heritage of an Enlightenment utopian vision, and in so many cases linked to deep social struggles against class oppression and race injustice, found its modernist credentials no longer good currency in the asocial, ahistorical, fashion-oriented glamour and glitz culture of a complacent globalizing capitalism, and has paid the price for remaining too serious, too worried about real abuse, social violence and violation, atrocity and the failure of the world to deliver at least minimum safety and sustenance to half of its population. It may be that the questions feminists posing are in fact too challenging, and phallocentrism has, as one would have expected, fought back with every dirty trick it knows. We find people now borrow our ideas, our strategies, our visions, and then forget to acknowledge where they got it from. Now, we have also been confused by the fact that in the 1980s, two radically dissimilar, but identical, apparently identical developments took over. On the one hand, I sat in a basement participating in alternative, radical, new social movement vision of a grassroots feminism allied to socialism and only just beginning to realize the enormity of its task. But down the road, capitalism's hunger for docile middle management lured educated women with the promise of escape from the burbs to the centers of business and administrative power, and women went with happiness in their hearts. With few exceptions, they would be content to support and never imagine they might lead. What most people think of as feminism has in fact been capitalism's accommodation to its earlier wastage of potentially valuable human resources, women. That statistics now show that more women or women are in the majority in employment in Western countries, combined with a similar statistic in areas of the world proletarianized by offshore Western industrial production, tells us something about the usefulness of women to current economic systems, but tells us nothing about feminism's radical project. Feminism once seemed so obvious. What intelligent woman... Okay, thank you. What intelligent woman would not be a feminist and be proud to stand and speak as a feminist, inheriting hundreds of years of struggle for human dignity for half of humanity? Now women shirk the idea, fearful of professional contamination, unwilling to acknowledge their debts politically, economically, culturally, to the intense struggle by feminism for even basic civil, sexual, and political equality that so many women take for granted. But the feminism these women resist is not the feminism that forms my lifeblood. It is a savage and reduced caricature filtered through the lens of this parallel capitalist revolution that sucked women into capitalism's new hyper-productive culture of work and hyper-sexualized culture of spectacle. Linda Nochlin's originating talk of paradigm shifts, of new ways of understanding how art, culture, and society and meaning intersect is something which we must hold on to. We must resist being confined to a cosmetic gesture in a tolerated side lobby. Feminism is not just a perspective, a methodology, an approach. And that is why I have always resisted the concept of feminist art history or feminist art. This allows the qualifying adjective to localize or even ghettoize my practice as an analyst of art, all of it. Like Beckett, I see the issue in terms of a struggle over the failure and limits of knowledge. The question, what can I know, is matched by others. What do we want to know? What do we need to know? What do we need to do to know differently? And to know difference. To attribute an abstract quality to feminism so that what I or any one of us considered a feminist is saying can simply be named as such and then contained as such, as if no more thought had to be given to the matters of which we speak, the work we do to make a difference. The labeling of the artist or art historian or argument reduces the living aspect of our thought as work in and on culture. Outside, feminism is not recognized as a vast intellectual and political enterprise, enriched from all the historically variable locations from which women are now speaking, and fertilized by all the historical and theoretical conversations with which we have re-educated ourselves as thinkers about art, image, and culture. Feminism is not understood by the outside world as that huge historical event of the 20th century when, for the very first time in history, women in large and sustained numbers entered education, spoke, studied, wrote, made artworks, films, and lives in their own names, asking themselves the scandalous question, what does a woman want? What am I? How was I formed? What else could I be? What do I have to be, want not to be? Imagine I could be. And I'm using I here not because I am against collective social action in favor of individualistic self-realization. It's because singularity is precisely what we learn from artists, those who dare to get up and think for themselves and tell the world, at least from this point of view, even if I'm thinking about myself or the world, this is how it appears. Now, this leads us to the great question that Kristeva, drawing on Duns Scotus, put forward when she talks about female genius, when she says that the case we have to make for artists is the right of women to say, who am I, not what am I? So we finally come to sexual difference, that most anxious of topics with which probably I have about 1 minute to say something. Why are people, notably women, notably academic and intellectual women, so damnably afraid of the very idea that there is a sexual difference of women? I know many of my friends think I sort of lost my marbles around 1992 when I became very interested in this question, but if feminism has a bad press, there is no word more contentious, even in feminist circles, than the feminine or femininity. Afraid of essentialism, of our loss of intellectual respectability by any association with the sexual specificity of femininity, we do not dare to keep the question open long enough to find out what the difference might be of what women could be if they were not simply defined in phallic terms as not men. Now, we face really serious and profound difficulties. Oops, we seem to have lost the key image there, unfortunately, which is the hotel, which is Eva Hesse's house. We face really profound and difficult questions that seesawing between various positions of positivism and extreme structuralism symptomize as the struggle to understand the chaos of history, past and present. Rather, I want to trace, and I'll finish any minute, the movement of a long-term collective but differentiatedly positioned set of inquiries across different intellectual and political terrains from an expanding feminist landscape to which I hope my PowerPoint is lending evidence, each moment responding to questions opened up in other places and by other artists. We are not in a post-theory age. We cannot be tired of the intellectual struggle. We need to derive from the past the concepts. We need to read and research the history of the last 30 years and stay loyal to the great event that was feminism in the 20th century, but also to stay loyal to the very concepts and ideas that were put forward. The one thing I want to say at the end is, as I view today and came through today, we seem to be still telling the same boring story. It was not like that. The 70s, the 80s, conservatives, forget that story. Why aren't we reading what Mary Kelly said about feminist interventions? Why are we not taking up the concepts that the great generation of women thinkers in philosophy and psychoanalysis and literary theory and anthropology and economics and politics? Art history has to import its concepts from this parallel intellectual revolution and see that we are feminism, not just feminist art history, which will always be a footnote to a situation that will tolerate us here, delight in taking our money, be glad there are so many people to come and listen to feminism, but probably do very little really constructively to change the world, the way art is presented to the world. Now, my final book is Virtuality, and I want to finish with that. The concept of virtuality first was because no one would really actually put anything I wanted in a museum, because what does this feminist know about art? But then the concept of the virtual is not synonymous with the possible, it's what is not yet realized. So my virtual feminist museum is the promise of feminism as the poesis to come. We do not know what women could be. We can only study what the Trojan horses artists have put into culture through their work, have offered us to read from and learn from. And if we see feminism as a perpetually becoming other that asks me to question what I'm doing, where I'm going, in whose name I'm speaking, we might find and sense the notion not of the future of feminism, but a feminist future, and indeed something that is rooted in the structural futurity of the feminine, because if anything the feminine stands for, it is the giving of life to another that will outlive me. It is the promise that I will not reclaim it, but I will also, as Brache Ettinger argues, I want to live beside that future. So this question of the feminist future seems to me the most exciting moment for us to grasp. The virtuality of feminism, not looking back and lodging ourselves in dead discussions about rationalizing models of what happened before, but constantly rereading every artwork and every art thought. And now I'm done.